I want you to imagine that a stranger walks up to you and says, "Hi, my name is Matt. Who are you?" How many of you would probably answer with your name? And that's reasonable, but what if that stranger then said, "Right, that's your name. But who are you?" What would you say then? I'll just use myself as an example. I think if they shut down our name as the explanation of who we are, we would probably go into things like, "I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a pastor, I work in real estate some. I was born in Indianapolis, I grew up in South Carolina, I've been here in Denver for the last 12 years. You'd say, I enjoy hiking, I enjoy sports, I enjoy travel. And what we would probably do is we would answer the question, "Who are you?" by telling people about our roles, our work, our relationships, our interests, our background. But still, is that really who we are? Or are we more than what we do? Are we more than who we know? Are we more than what we like? Who is the real you underneath it all? Underneath your name, underneath your interests, underneath the relationships that you're connected to, who are you? In other words, what is your real identity apart from those things which are part of your identity? And what is that identity built upon? We're asking these questions because the text we come to this morning is about identity. And specifically, it's about how a group of men come to Jesus and find their identity completely transformed from what they were to something else. So Luke chapter 6, verses 12 through 16 is what I'm going to read for you this morning. And before I even read those few verses, I'm going to give you my 4 points. Because even though we're just reading kind of a list of names and it's a very, very short text, I want you to listen for these 4 things. Luke is going to show us who the disciples were, who they became, how they got this new identity, and what they were supposed to do with it. Okay, who they were, who they became, how they got that way, and what they were supposed to do as a result of this new identity. Now, Luke chapter 6, verses 12 through 16. In these days, Jesus went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles: Simon, whom he named Peter, Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon who was called the Zealot, and Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. This is the word of the Lord. It's an interesting text. Again, first of all, who the disciples were. Now, Luke gives us here a list of 12 specific names. So if you lived in the time of Jesus, or maybe the next 10, 20, 30 years later, as these gospels are being written, you would say, "Oh, James, the son of Alphaeus. These are real historic people. I know who you're talking about." What's interesting is there are kind of 3 different quartets of 4. Leading off with Peter, Andrew, James, and John. Okay, let's talk about these people for just a moment. Do we know who these people are? Well, Peter is the fisherman that we just met back in chapter 5. Remember, Jesus is walking by the Sea of Galilee. He meets Peter. This is not the first time they've met, but he meets Peter. He calls him to leave everything and follow him, and Peter obeys. Now, Andrew here in this list is simply referred to as Simon Peter's brother. And you'll see this throughout the Gospels, that Andrew's kind of always taking a backseat to Simon. He's probably the younger brother. But he's probably just less impetuous, probably less out there than what the character of Peter is. He's always kind of being overshadowed by Peter's brashness. But these two are brothers and fishermen. And then Luke gives us James and John, who are also brothers, the sons of this man named Zebedee. And they too are fishing partners, and the 4 of these work together. And day after day, they're working this middle class, honorable job, catching fish, selling fish, providing food for people's tables. We go on here, and the next 2 are Philip and Bartholomew. By the way, we're starting to get into names. You're like, "Peter, James, and John. Okay, yeah, I know stories about these guys. But Bartholomew? I mean, what do you know about Bartholomew?" You know, one of the only stories in the Bible about Philip and Bartholomew is actually Philip introduces Bartholomew to Jesus. And he introduces him this way. He goes to Bartholomew and says, "Hey, we have found the one. that the law and prophets talk about, and his name is Jesus of Nazareth. And Bartholomew's reply, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Those are Bartholomew's only words in the Bible. So Jesus is calling a man who at the very least is socially prejudiced to say, Bumpkin Town, Nazareth, you're telling me the Messiah is coming from there? And Jesus says, hey, Philip, Bartholomew, follow me. Matthew's the next one. We just talked about him at the end of chapter 5, where he was called by his Greek name, Levi. So Matthew or Levi was this tax collector. He's this hated Jew because he's collaborating with the Romans and he's taking people's hard-earned money. Then Thomas is the last of this group, and this is the first time his name has been mentioned in Luke. But of course, later on, Thomas will become most famous for doubting the resurrection of Jesus. And as the other disciples see Jesus and touch Jesus after he's risen from the dead, Thomas says, I'll never believe unless I see him with my own eyes. So that's your second four. Now, moving on to the final quartet, you've got this guy named James, the son of Alphaeus. He's actually called James the Less, or literally James the Little. So we don't know if that little means that he was little in stature or if he was young. Could mean that he was just simply insignificant compared to the other James, who was a fisherman. But he's calling someone who's literally, like, everybody just knows him as, like, James the Little Guy. Simon is the next one. Simon's interesting because he's called a zealot. And Luke and the other Gospels call this out. Now, the zealots were an official party, like a political party. And this party is known for being not just anti-Roman in the sense that the general Jew sitting there is like, man, I do not like this Roman government thing. It's oppressive. We're not as free as we could be. Now, these were the people who trained out in the wilderness to be assassins. Okay, they're like, we hate the Roman rule so much and we hate the people who collaborate with the Roman rule so much. We're willing to sneak up and attack them and kill them. We hate Jewish sympathizers. So this is interesting because Simon the Zealot's looking over at Matthew, the tax collector who collaborates with the Romans, and is like, I hate this guy. Two more. Judas, the son of James. We know almost nothing about him in the Bible except that he has two nicknames or two surnames. And I won't tell you what they are except to say that it's something similar to the modern expression mama's boy. James was a mama's boy. And so much so, whatever that means, that this was the moniker that was given to him. He's a mama's boy. And then in stark contrast, the final of the 12 is the infamous Judas Iscariot. And even at this point, Luke calls him out as the one who became a traitor. Iscariot. Iscariot means son of Kerioth. Kerioth was in Judea. So it's interesting. The traitor, Judas, is the only one of the 12 who was not a hated lesser Galilean. He was the only one of the 12 who was a Judean. So I want you to think about this for a moment. I mean, Luke calls out, Jesus has just gone up to a mountain by himself and he spends the entire night in prayer and comes down off that mountain after talking to his father all night saying, who do you want me to select and how many do you want me to select? And these are the 12 that Jesus selects. I want to make three observations about this, who these guys were and who they were not. Number one, you see that Jesus' disciples were nobodies from nowhere. And we've already run into that theme in the book of Luke because remember when the annunciation of Jesus' birth is first made, it's first made to a preteen girl from Nazareth, a nobody from nowhere. The Virgin Mary, who would have been scorned, who would have been a nothing in her culture until she got married, and then she would become a little something and had children, and then she'd be a little bit more something, but she's none of that. And God chooses her to bring the Messiah into the world. Now we see this theme starting to repeat itself over and over again in this gospel, that Jesus almost displays a preference for nobodies from nowhere. He almost displays a preference for people who seemingly have nothing to offer him. And he's passing over people that have piled up their merits in life by doing lots of good things or being important people. And he's passing over them and saying, I choose these people instead. Besides that, I mentioned this, they're outsiders. 11 of the 12 were hated, unsophisticated Galileans. And by the way, the people in Jerusalem, the capital city of their people, they would look up north at these Galileans, and even as fellow Jews, they would think, these people are pathetic. These people are nothing. I think the only thing remarkable about these 12 is how unremarkable they are. They're passing out high school yearbooks at the end of the year. These guys are labeled as most likely to succeed at nothing. They don't make that section. They're just in the group that gets passed over for those kinds of awards and recognition. Secondly, you see here that Jesus' disciples were a diverse group. At least four of them were fishermen. One was a tax collector. One was a political revolutionary. One was a mama's boy. And one was a dagger man. That's what the word literally is. A guy who carries a little assassin's sword. So they have diverse backgrounds, diverse occupations, diverse temperaments, and get this, diverse political views. And Jesus is calling these 12, come, follow me. And you love this because you've got some blood brothers, you've got some friends and business partners, but you've got a bunch of loners who really don't seem to get along with anyone. And Jesus is saying, come. Okay, I'm not building a fraternity. This isn't, you know, Pi Kappa, whatever, where a bunch of us just look all alike and come from the same well-to-do backgrounds. And we carry ourselves the same way and we dress ourselves the same way and we have the same views on everything. Jesus is picking no two are alike. And some of them would have even hated each other. Now, one thing that these men are not, they're not influential. And I want you to just think of that in contrast to today's political parties and how people today try to get a new political revolution or even a new religion off the ground. Is they're going to people with influence. Okay, and this culture was not that different from today in terms of how you get influence. You get influence through money, power, pedigree, in other words, what family you come from, or education. So, you know, if you put yourself in Jesus' shoes, you're trying to get a new religion off the ground, which in fact was not new, but that's how people viewed it. He's trying to get the gospel off the ground, the kingdom of God, and not one of them was a religious leader of any kind. He didn't pick one Pharisee, one Sadducee, one priest, one Levite, one scribe, one lawyer of the law, one rabbi of a synagogue, nothing, not one. You think, too, you know, what is this Jesus movement going to need? Well, it's going to need money. So at least pick one wealthy person. You know, the only probably wealthy person that he picked was Matthew or Levi, who had gotten his wealth how? By extorting fellow Jews. And the moment Jesus calls Levi to follow him, what does Matthew do with his wealth? He walks away from it. So he's got a bunch of poor people, at best middle class. Finally, you'd think that Jesus would have gotten someone who is an intellectual or social elite, someone who can run with other people, to help him build this thing. And Jesus doesn't pick anybody intellectual. Nobody in this group is formally educated. In fact, later on in the book of Acts, you know, Jesus' enemies are going to be astonished by what these disciples are doing after Jesus' death and resurrection. They're going to look at these guys and say, how is it possible that these, and these are the two words they use, how is it possible that these uneducated, common men have so much power? And then they answer their own question. They say, because they've been with Jesus. So the first application I want to make is, don't you dare think you know who God's going to use and who God isn't going to use. Don't you dare look at someone from the outside and say, oh, they look rough, no money, lacking in education, just barely got their GED. And we can make our list and think, OK, in our culture today, we're this kind of culture. This is who God's going to need to break through. And really, don't us dare think that way, that we know the paradigm of the person that God is going to use. Because Jesus tends to use the opposite of the kind of people that we think he's going to use. He uses the people we least expect. He uses broken, empty people that have no credentials. You know why? Because those kinds of people tend to understand, apart from the grace of God, nothing good is going to happen. God's calling me to public speaking. How could I possibly do that? I've never taken a speech class. I've never done this or that. And by the way, many of you are highly educated. I'm not knocking your education, but don't think for a moment that God is using you because of your education. He could use you in spite of your education. So use what God has given you, certainly for a gospel advantage, but be open to the reality that God is using beautifully messed up, broken, empty people with no credentials. All right, so that's who these guys were. Now, point two, who they became. I want you to focus on verse 13 for just a moment. Luke says this, and when day came, so remember Jesus had spent the night in prayer. When day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12. Now, let's just stop there. Do you know throughout the rest of the gospel and the other gospels, this group is often going to be referred to simply as the 12. The 12 went and did this. Then the 12 did this. Then the 12 did this. And the first thing I want you to see from that is that who did these individuals, who did these brothers, who did these business partners become? They became a community. They became a new people. And I mean new people collectively. A new people of God. Let me show this to you. So prior to Jesus' call, these are just a bunch of individuals. And some of them knew each other, but they're just a bunch of individuals. But when Jesus comes into their life, he calls them not only into a vertical relationship with God, like, oh, I have a one-on-one, I have a very, you know, faith is a very private thing for me. No, he says, okay, great, vertical relationship with God, but you are called into relationship with one another. And you are establishing a new community. You're establishing a fellowship that's bigger than just the sum of the individual parts. But I want you to notice this too, that Jesus doesn't make them the four. Jesus doesn't make them the 10. Jesus doesn't make them the 27 or the 100 or the 1,000. Jesus makes them the 12. And do you know why? Well, consider the context. Okay, you're looking at Luke chapter 6, verse 12. You know, if you back up a couple verses, this is the story we looked at last week. Jesus is there, verse 7, Luke 6, 7. And the scribes and the Pharisees watched him. Why? Do you remember why they're watching him? They're watching him to catch him, to trap him, doing something that's against their rules. Why? So that they can kick him out because they're jealous of him. And we concluded last week's story by reading this verse, verse 11. But they, that is the religious elites, were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to get rid of Jesus. So these are the guardians, you know, the religious elites. They are the guardians of Israel's identity. We are the people of God. What makes you the people of God? Well, we have the rules, and we have the temple, and we have circumcision, and we have, you know, and they would go through their list of things. This is what makes us the people of God. And this is really, really powerful in this context, that on the heels of these guardians of Israel's identity are saying, we reject you, Jesus. Jesus says, fine, I reject you too. I reject you, 12 tribes. You don't get into my kingdom simply because you are blood related to someone Jewish. He's saying right here, I'm picking 12. What is he doing? He's essentially constituting a new nation. He's replacing the 12 tribes of Israel and saying, there's a new people, there's a new kingdom, and this is what it's going to look like. It's going to look like a bunch of nobodies. And these guys happen to be Jews, but I'm not picking them because they're Jews. I'm picking them because my grace can work through their lives. And no longer are my people going to be about this law and this temple. They're going to be about a new law and a new temple and grace and the gospel and me, because it's my life and death and resurrection that's going to make everything change. So you see what's at the heart of this new community that Jesus is forming? Again, it's not race. It's not ethnicity. It's not a bloodline. Now, this is who these guys are becoming. They're becoming defined by their relationship to Jesus. And that's it. Okay, why are you here? Well, I don't know. Why are you here? And I imagine the first meeting of these guys. These 12 go into some room somewhere. And I'll bet some of them couldn't even look at each other. You know, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. Matthew's been ripping them off for years. Can you imagine being in a room and being like, okay, Jesus, I understand why you chose us. We're middle class, hardworking, decent, honorable guys. But seriously, you're going to choose Levi? They probably didn't want to look at him. And then Simon the Zealot's looking across the room, probably reaching for his sword. I got my eye on you, Matthew. And when the moment comes, you're dead. So they could have looked around the room and said, you know, like an AA meeting, well, why are you here? Why are you here? Why are you here? Why are you here? And they could have gone through like, well, this is who I am. This is what I've done. But I think the only reason I'm here is because I know Jesus. 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 You know, that's the only thing these men had in common was Jesus. This is the kind of community that Jesus is forming, that your whole identity is going to be birthed out of one thing: relationship to Jesus. Let me use two other words for this now. These men's lives came to be defined as a community of grace, because Jesus didn't invite any of them to the table because of what they could do for Jesus. Jesus invited all these men to the table because of what he could do for them. That's grace. He's saying, you have no credentials. You have no merits to stand on whatsoever. Fine. I'm calling you to serve me because of what I can and will do for you. Secondly, the second word I would use is not just grace, but reconciliation. Because every one of these men walking either in the law or in rebellion to the law is not properly related to God. And the first thing Jesus wants to do is give them peace with God, and then to give them peace with each other. And say, you look around the room, if you want to define yourself by your politics or your job or your social status, you're going to continue to fight with each other and be mad at each other. And there's going to be angst and hatred and pride and fear. And all of that's going to go on in this room, and the community is going to blow itself apart. But if every one of you understands the reason I'm here is because I need Jesus, and so do you, and so do you, then we can be a community of reconciliation. From this moment forward, these men need a new identity if they're going to function as a community. And that's what Jesus gives them, is a new identity. Okay, so let's talk about that. It's a new identity of grace. It's a new identity of they're forgiven, mercy, purpose, hope, eternal life. They get all that. How did they get it? That's point three. How did they get that new identity? Now, verses 13 through 14, one more time. And when day came, Jesus called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles, Simon, whom he named Peter. Okay, I just emphasize four things for you. And you notice in every case of what I emphasized, it is Jesus who initiated. Okay, look at this. First of all, Jesus calls, and that word sounds exactly like what it means. There's this whole big, huge group of Jesus followers. They love his teaching. They love his miracles. They're bringing more friends and even strangers, like, heal this guy too. Heal this woman. Whoa, Jesus is amazing. And all these people are following him. And the very first thing Jesus does, he comes down off the mountain. He spent all night in prayer. He's alone. And he says, I call you all to come. Secondly, Jesus chooses. That's a little more important word because it means out of all the people now that he's called to him, he's making a special choice of a few. OK, another week in a few days, some of you are going to go to a polling place and you're going to make a special choice of a few. Right. We call it an election because you go in and for various reasons and different ones, you have different reasons. You say, I choose this person over all these others, or I choose this policy over all of these others. Well, in essence, that's what Jesus is doing here. He's saying, out of all of you, OK, you have your reasons for electing who you elect. I have reasons for electing who I elect too. And for Jesus, it's all about grace. You know, before Jesus goes to the cross, he's going to sit these guys down, John 15. He's going to say, you did not choose me. I chose you. You know, Peter, James and John, I mean, tax collector, you were not the guys gravitating toward me and saying, I want you, Jesus. You are my rabbi. I will follow you anywhere. These guys were just all doing their own thing. And Jesus interrupted their lives and said, I choose you. Follow me. Thirdly, Jesus commissions them. This is the next phrase. I mean, saying he named them apostles, that's kind of an interesting way of putting it. It means he designated them as apostles. He commissioned them as apostles. What does the word apostle mean? It means, well, literally, it means a sent one, but they're being sent with a message. And this is Jesus' whole idea, is like, you have all these different vocations, all these different roles, all these different relationships. Now I'm commissioning you for a new and special role. Just come and listen and then go and tell. So he's commissioning them. Jesus is taking the initiative. By the way, think about that. None of these guys are trained theologians. None of them has public speaking experience. None of them has none of them are rabbis with a synagogue where they're like, OK, I can see where I'm going to talk about Jesus. But this is what's so fascinating is Jesus says, you have no credentials, you have no experience in doing what I'm calling you to do, but come follow me and I will equip you. And by the way, that's the very next story that this story bleeds into is what is Jesus doing now? He's brought these 12. He's calling them, choosing them, commissioning them, and then he's fleshing it out in front of them. He's mentoring them is what he's doing. And that order is very important, that Jesus equips the chosen. He doesn't choose the equipped. OK, so if you're sitting there, you're thinking like, oh, who should I share the gospel with? Or, oh, I know why he chose me. It's because I have this and this and this going on for me, and I could see why God would want someone like me. That's not how Jesus works. He's like, I can choose a nobody and equip them. Finally, you see Jesus characterizes. And that's why I read through this first phrase of verse 14, because what Jesus does with Simon is illustrative of what he's doing with all the disciples. OK, so he says, Simon, I'm calling you. And guess what? In my calling you, you have a new name, and your new name is Peter. Does that sound weird? Oh, now you're attending this church. What's your name? That's not your name anymore. You got a new name. I mean, we wouldn't do that, but Jesus does that. Why? And what's going on here? This is very important to understand. You know, Simon's a common name. It's a fine name. It's a good name. It's a reputable name. But for this particular Simon, that Simon name was tied to his past. If he follows Jesus as Simon, Simon's all he's ever going to be, in essence. And Jesus is basically saying, Simon, I know you. You're an impetuous man. You're an anxious man. But in me, when you ground your identity in me, you are going to become a new man. And that man is going to be fearless. That man is going to be immovable. That man is going to be Peter, which means rock. I love what Jesus is doing here. You realize when Jesus says, you're not Simon anymore, you're rock. He's not describing what he saw in Peter. Oh, Peter, you have rock-like traits. No, Peter was this waffling, vacillating, impetuous, like, ooh, let's do this. And the first to stick his foot in his mouth, the first to take a swing at somebody with a sword. That's Peter. So Jesus is not describing why he chose Peter. He's describing what Peter will become because he chose him. Peter, because I chose you, you will become a rock. And you look at the book of Acts, and that's exactly who Peter is. Oh, you want me to stop preaching the gospel or you'll do what? You'll kill me. Okay, well, I'm sorry. I'm taking orders from a higher level. I have to proclaim the things I've seen and heard. Jesus died and Jesus rose again. That's who he becomes. You know, how many of you have named someone or something? Anybody? That's a bunch of you. If you have kids, you probably named them. Pets. A lot of the naming that we do is descriptive, right? You know, you pick up this stray cat. I don't know why. Some of you would. You pick up this stray cat and you're like, oh, Tiger, you know, or Shadow or Lucifer. You know, you're being descriptive. You're describing the nature of the thing. OK. Or, you know, in high school, my friends called I had a 1980 Ford Fairmont and my friends called it the Burgundy Bomb. Descriptive. OK. You know, we have parks and stuff around here. Lookout Mountain or Confluence Park. Descriptive. But do you know that what Jesus is doing here with Peter is not descriptive? I'm going to drill that into you. It's not describing what he found in Peter. It is determinative. And you see this from the very beginning of Scripture, that in Genesis 1, God is standing there and he's not saying, well, in observing the daylight qualities of day, I shall name you day. And night seems pretty dark, so I guess I'll... No, he's saying, because I call you day, you are bright and you are glorious and you are this. Because I call you night, you take on these attributes. It's determinative. And I love that this is what Jesus is doing with Peter and his disciples, and that's what he's doing with us. He's saying, I'm renaming you. And in my renaming you, I'm saying this is and this will be true of you. And there will be times where it doesn't seem true, it doesn't feel true, it doesn't look true. But because you're in relationship with me, it is true. And by the way, what a freeing thing that is, if you believe that. Because these 12 guys could be sitting around the room, Jesus walks out the first time, and they're like, did you guys hear what I heard? Like, we're the apostles. we're the message bearers now. We're going to go and do greater miracles than he did. Because what? I don't know about you. I know how to tie a lure. I know how to rip somebody off. I know how to stab somebody in the back. Guys, we need something else. And they would just sit around the room staring at their navels like, how in the world are we going to do this? But if they believe that what Jesus says about them is determinative, if they believe Jesus is calling, Jesus is choosing, Jesus is commissioning, Jesus is characterizing who we become, then they understand we're just the channels and God's going to do it all somehow. It's a very freeing thing to believe. To believe that Jesus is saying to them, I will do it through you because this is your new identity. Okay, point four then, what are they supposed to do with that? And by that, I mean their new identity. What are they supposed to do now that Jesus has just said, you're not this random collection of individuals, but you are a new people of God. A community of grace, a community of reconciliation, a community that does certain things. Well, I think that this new identity that Jesus gives them makes the what do we do now pretty simple. Because Jesus says, you're disciples and you're apostles. So that implies two things. Number one, follow Jesus. Okay, what do we do? What do we do with this new identity, Jesus? This new identity where it's all about you and not really about us. It's about your qualifications, not our qualifications and credentials. Well, then follow the one who gives you that identity. You know, and this is what the word disciple means. Disciple means a learner or a follower. But there's something interesting about this word disciple. There's a nuance here because we think of a student. You can be someone's student. You can sit. Many of you have been to college. You can sit in a lecture hall. It's 1,000 people in your class. You gain what from the teacher? You gain information from the teacher. This is not the word disciple. The word disciple is not simply, oh, I'm learning. OK, I'm learning more information. You know, inherent in this word disciple is not just information, but relationship. Intimacy. It was always understood in Jewish culture, if you're someone's disciple, you are becoming like them through relationship. You know, it's not unlike a marriage in some ways. You know, people stand at the altar and they exchange vows. And I hear people say this sometimes. It's so cute. I vow to never stop learning about you.
Oh, me too. I vow the same. I will keep learning.
What are they saying? Like, I just want to get more and more and more information about you. That would not make for a very good marriage. If all you're gaining is information, factoids, I can tell you lots of interesting factoids about my wife. Well, do you love her? No, but I continue to grow in my understanding of her. Inherent in this word disciple is intimacy. It is that the knowledge that you're gaining is in the context of relationship. And it's like, OK, now I know more. Yes, from my head. But now my heart is beginning to burst with what I'm seeing and understanding and experiencing in relationship with Jesus. And this is what I mean by follow Jesus. It's not just go to church and read your Bible and gain some information. It is follow with your heart and say, Lord, let everything I learn about you not just go to my head, but go to my heart and change me and draw me closer to you. So I love myself, my flesh less, and I love you more and I enjoy you more. Follow Jesus. And then the only other thing they're supposed to do with it is now tell. Follow Jesus and tell about Jesus. Again, like the very next thing that we would come into if we read 17 through, I think, 21 is Jesus starts doing this in front of them. He says, I call you to follow me. Now let me mentor you. Let me show you. Because right now, if Jesus just called them and said, now go and tell, they would say, go and tell what, Jesus? Go and tell what? Well, go and tell what you've seen and heard. And this is why Jesus says, first, follow me. So you can know me, so you can love me and experience my love at work in you. And then you go and tell. And what are you going and telling? You're not making up some story. You're not following a script. You're just simply eyewitnesses of good news. You're just simply going out and saying, this is what I saw. This is what I heard. That's what an apostle is. And do you know, by the way, that Jesus tells them, you're going to go tell the world what you saw. You're going to go tell the world what you heard. You bunch of nobodies. And they're not even a bunch. It's only 12. You 12 are going to tell the world what you saw and heard, and you're going to change the world. makes me excited because I realize if we had 12 in this church who just said, you know what, I'm one of the 12. Or maybe there are 15 or 20 or 50 or 100. But I will follow Jesus this way, and I will tell about Jesus this way, and I will expect God to be changing other people's lives and doing his kingdom work through little old me. Because it's him at work through me. By the way, do you notice how Jesus connects what his disciples do with who they are? I think we often lose sight of that as Christians. We're like, oh man, now I got to go to church. Now I got to read my Bible. Now I got to pray. Now I have to serve somebody. Now I'm supposed to tell somebody and invite them and be evangelist. Like, how many layers of doing are there in this Christian life thing? I have to do that too. It's going to be a burdensome way to live if that's how you think about it. I'll come back to that thought in just a moment. Because I want to show you how everything you do in the Christian life is connected to who you are. In fact, it flows naturally out of who you are. Let's go to this, gospel applications. Let me just close with four simple things. Because it's one thing to look at a story and say, wow, look at what Jesus is starting to do in the lives of those other people. Wouldn't that have been great? Well, Jesus is making the same calling to you. Come, follow me. It's a general invitation. There's always that general invitation. Come, follow me. Let me start with this. Gospel application one, do not worry about what identity you bring to Jesus. And I mean that for yourself, and I mean that as you try to bring others. Don't worry for one second, well, who am I bringing? What's their mess? Listen, if Jesus is going to make all things new, do you think he really cares that you are, you're a liar, a thief, an adulterer, instead of just simply being a proud, self-righteous gossip? So why couldn't a murderer come? Why couldn't an adulterer come? If Jesus, again, is going to make all things new, does it matter at all what you bring to Jesus? Because I know some people that I've talked to here that are like, I don't know that I'm ready to do that. You don't understand how bad I am. Well, I probably don't, but you don't understand how good Jesus is. You don't understand how big the cross is. Jesus is not worried about what identity you bring to him. You look at that name of 12 and you tell me the guy on there who deserved to be at the table. There wasn't one of them. Don't worry about what you bring to Jesus. Just come as you are and just bring other people with you as they are. Step one. Two, let go of any identity not rooted in who you are in Christ. Okay, so here's where we go all the way back to that beginning question. I asked you, who are you? But let me ask it now like this. What are you seeking your identity in? We're all seeking our identity in something. And what I mean by that is we all have something, a who or a what, that makes us feel like, okay, now I'm significant. Now this is who I am. And I know people, I counsel people. They feel like I've gone my whole life and I've tried all these different things and I've never landed on like who I am. I can do this and I can do this and I've tried this and failed at this and I look like this, but I don't understand who is the real me. And so we all go looking. And apart from Christ, this is all we can do is go looking. I want to feel significant. I want to feel like I'm a somebody. I want to feel unique, like I have personhood, and you do. And when what traditional cultures tend to do is traditional cultures say, okay, find your identity in family. Family's really good. You know, be a good mom. Stay home from work. Don't let anybody tell you that's a demeaning job to have. Family. Character. Just be a good person. You know, religion. Go to church. Do good things. And more for the men in a traditional culture, money, work, vocation, go work hard, provide for your family, find your identity. Maybe you're a terrible husband, but you provided for your family. And progressive cultures are sick of that traditional model of like, why would you seek your identity in that? And they say, let's find our identity in freedom of expression and sexuality. And they have their different things. And they're all looking for their identity and this other stuff instead of this stuff. And I mean, there's a lot of crossover. We're looking for identity in politics. We're looking for identity in physical fitness, in body image. I mean, all kinds of things. My question is, what do you seek your identity in? What do you cling to because you say, this is who I am? You know, when Jesus does what he does in these few verses, Peter, Andrew, James and John could have said, we're not following because our identity is tied to fishing, Jesus. This is who we are. If we leave that, who do we become? What do we have? It's a big question mark following you, Jesus. That is not a question mark. That was a good life. You know, Matthew could have done the same. No, Jesus, what I know I'm kind of the bad boy of the group. I'm extorting my people, but I've got my friends too. I've got people that run with me. And maybe I'm the rebel, maybe I'm the outcast, but I'm comfortable with that identity. And Simon the Zealot could have said, Jesus, what, I can't follow you. You've got salvation for Romans. What is it going to do to my zealot? Like, I'm a zealot. That's who I am. Again, Judas, the second Judas, he could have said, I'm a mama's boy. I got to be there for my mom. I mean, we could go one by one through these guys and they all had things they could have said. Jesus, I can't follow you and embrace that new identity of just being in relationship with you by grace, being reconciled to God because I have all this stuff. And they let go because it wasn't rooted in who they were in Christ. But what about you? What are you seeking your identity in? Because here's my fear. Some of you go through life clutching that little thing. And here's my concern. That thing that you hold on to and you say, that is what I find my identity in. In a group like this, it's what's in your hand is probably valuable. Somebody going to me, you say, I'm finding my identity in family. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you your family's not valuable. Find my identity in my job, my money. A character, that's valuable. But it's not valuable in light of what Christ offers you in its place. And my fear is some of you are going to die clutching a penny. Penny has value, diminishing value, but it has value. And you're going to die clutching your penny. This is who I am. If I gave that up, and you think it's way more valuable than a penny, don't you? If I gave that up, who would I be? And Jesus is like, you would be this, a $1 trillion treasure this. Don't die clutching a penny. Let go of any identity not rooted in who you are in Christ. Number three, let Christ determinatively tell you who you are. Again, Jesus doesn't look at you and say, okay, here's what I see. I see this good and this good and this good and this good and this good. You guys are awesome. Don't change a thing. It's not what he's doing. He's looking at you and saying, in essence, this isn't how you come to me, but this is who you are. And I want to just give you a quick rundown on a couple things he says. He says, you're forgiven. You are free. You are holy and righteous in me. You're saints. He says, you are my bride and I love you forever and always with an unbreaking, unconditional love. He says, you are adopted into my family as my child. Therefore, you're a joint heir with Jesus Christ. Everything Jesus deserves, you get with him forever. He says, that's who you are. You are my temple. I put myself in you. You're a member of my body. I'm the head, but you are part of my body. You are reconciled. You are alive forever. He says all these things. He says that's who you are. And you could on any given day say, but I don't feel adopted right now. I feel like an orphan. And we go back to living like orphans. And God would say, but you are. You are what I say you are. And nothing is going to mess that up. Do you know why? Because your identity is not based on, again, I've said this, but your identity is not based on what you can do for God. Your identity is based on what God has done for you through Jesus. So he's not saying, if you behave yourself, I'll take you as my bride. If you continue to make every day more fun than the day before, we can continue to do this marriage dance thing. He just says, you are my bride, period. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. Why? Because it's not dependent on you. It's dependent on me. What great news. Do you believe that? And are you letting Christ determinatively tell you, this is who you are? I'm not describing you. I'm defining the rest of your life. Another way of thinking of it is Jesus is not sticking a thermometer in your mouth and taking your temperature and then telling you, oh, You're a 101. Jesus is setting the thermostat of your life. Your temperature will be this. You will be this because I'm setting it that way. Then finally, go and live in the reality of who Christ says you are. So I said I'd come back to this, how what you do is related to who you are. It flows out of who you are. So let me just give you a couple examples of that. If we, the church, are the bride of Christ, he is the groom, then we listen and we talk. We don't just like go have devotions. We need to read our Bible today and pray. No, if we're in this marriage, we communicate. I want to hear what my husband's saying to me. So I listen. I read his word. He's left letters for me. I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to tell him what's on my heart. That's what prayer is. I'm going to depend on him. That's what prayer is. Next, if he's the vine and we are the branches, as Jesus told his disciples, then we realize, okay, then all of my life flows from you. Apart from you, I can do nothing. So I'm going to go in your strength and do whatever it is that you send me to do. And I'm just going to believe, you know what? You're a big enough vine to handle supplying whatever you've called me to go do. If you are the sovereign Father and I am your child, then I am free to be radically generous with my money because you will keep giving as your children give away. It's not like, well, we're going to take the offering now. Oh, great. Another thing to do in the Christian life. No, if you believe this is my identity, I'm a child of the King. I've got this inheritance. I can't outgive this thing. It's a different perspective altogether. A couple more examples. If Jesus is the head and we are his body, then you're never like, oh, man, now I got to serve. This church is telling me I should get off my backside and serve someone, help someone. That's another thing to do. No, it's not. No, it's not. You're a member of a body. Your body members instinctively do this to help one another. If that's your identity, this is just what happens. Finally, if Jesus is, in fact, the King and we are, in fact, his ambassadors, then we go and tell people about him. We just represent him accurately and winsomely because that's what we enjoy doing. And by the way, if you have no impulse to do the things that Christians automatically do, the most likely explanation is what? Branches just bear fruit. That's what they do. Body members just serve one another. That's just what they do. They don't think about it. Couples that are in love talk and listen. It doesn't feel like another thing we have to do with our day. They're wanting to draw near. So again, my question, if we have no impulse to do the things that being identified with Christ just produces automatically, I think the most plausible explanation is we don't have a relationship with that Christ. And you can this morning. By simply saying, Lord, I turn from my sin. And part of that is just making my own identity, forging my own way. And it may be a religious thing. It may be a rebellious thing. But you say, I'm willing to give that up to come into this grace, to come into this reconciliation and power and hope and forgiveness and life. And by the way, when you do that, then you have a truly integrated life because everything you do, everything you say is coming out of who you are. That's real life. That's why Jesus said, if you save your life, we're coming to this text very soon. If you save your life, you'll lose it. You'll die with a penny clutched in your hand. Oh, okay, maybe yours is a nickel or a dime. You're clutching to different things of different values. I get that. But you're going to die with spare change in your hand when he offered you the moon. Will you leave the self-made identity behind to follow this Jesus who makes you your real self?